344715, Esurance Property and Casualty Insurance versus Michigan Assigned Claims. We have two counsel present.
Good morning, Your Honors. Drew Broadus for the plaintiff appellant, Esurance. And this is our appeal from dismissal, the subrogation suit under C-8. It's, I think, a relatively simple appeal. It's the one thing we both agree on, I think, is that it's easy. We think it's easy for different reasons, obviously. But what it boils down to, the arguments in the trial court were essentially, were the assigned claims, were the insurer of last resort, the insurer, the No-Fault Act treats us differently, so we can't be sued. And I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, but not a whole lot more complicated. The bottom line is, certainly assigned claims is treated differently in a lot of ways, but that's not a reason not to permit this suit. The subrogation against a higher and priority carrier isn't in the No-Fault Act for anybody, yet it's been recognized, Titan versus North Shore, Federal Temper, several published cases cited in my brief. So I think everybody agrees it wouldn't be a controversial case if it was just us suing a higher and priority insurer that we found after we paid, rescinded the policy, and then said, this is the one that should have paid. That's clearly allowed under established law, and that's nowhere allowed for in the No-Fault Act. So what is the reason why the suit couldn't go forward? I submit there's none. When you look at the statute, certainly they're treated differently, but they're also suable. If you step into the look at what the subrogation theory is, we step into the shoes of the individual we paid on behalf of, that individual could have sued to compel an assignment. And there was this idea floating around in the trial court that maybe they're not a suable entity. That's clearly not the case. There's much case law cited in my brief. There's a recent case that Judge Swartz was on the panel that was published about 2 weeks ago, Spectrum Health, 343563. I didn't file a statement of supplemental authority on that.
What's the name?
It's Spectrum Health versus assigned claims. I didn't file a statement of supplemental authority because I didn't want to confuse the issues. But the importance of that case is simply the fact that they were sued and that suit was allowed to proceed, and there was no issue of standing and there was no issue of any sort of immunity conferred by the act. So here we have a situation where Esurance, in a fairly odd fact pattern in the underlying rescission issue, stepped up and did the right thing ultimately. They paid promptly. They made sure that the injured person's benefits were paid as the act requires us to. It was a decision we had to make fairly quick under a penalty of 12% interest and attorney fees. And so the question becomes, why are we not allowed to step in his shoes? We would have been if a higher and priority insurer had been found and timely notified. That part's not controversial, and I submit there's simply nothing in the statute that compels this dismissal.
Okay. Questions? No.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Phillips on behalf of the MAIPF. The assigned claims plan is a remedial benefit pool for folks injured in accidents as a last resort. It's not an insurance program for insurance carriers, which is what plaintiff is attempting to turn it into with this action. It has been redundantly held by this court that there's an order of priority with the assigned claims plan coming at the end of the priority. There's absolutely no authority of any kind, anywhere, for this type of action. The cases that were cited by plaintiff deal with different circumstances. One dealt with the workers' compensation statute, that would be auto owners versus AMECO. And that statute had right in there a right to reimbursement, and that's what they were subrogating to, an explicit statute. There is no explicit statute for reimbursement in the situation where a carrier in the order of priority pays and then later questions whether they should have paid and seeks to get reimbursement through the plan. The legislature knows how to create reimbursement statutes. It knows how to give entities rights to reimbursement because it did it multiple times in the No-Fault Act. The assigned claims and its servicing insurers, for example, have an explicit right to reimbursement against third parties, and within that, there are explicit provisions for statute of limitations and timing and the mechanism of how to pursue the reimbursement. There are other examples of explicit rights to reimbursement being given. There is no right to reimbursement given to a carrier in the circumstances that we have in this case against the assigned claims. And again, no authority, no case. No one has ever, in as many years as the plan has existed, suggested that that was possible until now. 3172 is a statute that allows injured people to make claims to the assigned claims plan, and it has four discrete circumstances where a person can make a claim. There is no circumstance where an insurance company can make a claim for reimbursement. In order for a plaintiff to be successful, there would need to be that type of provision in the act, and there is not. And furthermore, the injured person, Rashawn White, is not eligible because he didn't fall within any of the four circumstances where a claim can be assigned, because there was coverage and continues to be coverage despite the DEC action, which I'll address in just a minute, with Esurance. Esurance paid benefits, so a lot of benefits, for a long time. This accident was in January of 2016. They didn't file their DEC action against Rashawn White until November of 2016. If Esurance thought it did not owe the benefits, it has a remedy, and that is the remedy of self-help. Don't pay the benefits. And if they're wrong, there's a consequence in the act, and that's interest and attorney fees. They'll owe interest and attorney fees if they're wrong. If they're right, keep the money in the pocket. If they believe that they don't owe the benefits, don't pay them. In this case, they voluntarily paid the benefits. In excess of 10 months later, they file a DEC action asserting, maybe we think now we shouldn't have paid these benefits. The remedy is self-help. Don't pay the benefits, and if you're wrong, you're gonna owe interest and attorney fee. And if you're right, good for you. And Mr. White would have come through the plan. That's the structure of the No-Fault Act. Because otherwise it would turn the plan into something it's not designed to be, as the insurer for insurance companies who second guess their decisions.
So if we agree with you, does Esurance have any remedy against any other party?
Sure, I think it could go against the medical providers that it paid for reimbursement.
But that was for services that were actually performed.
I think there would be an equitable basis to say that if they believe they didn't owe and turn out to be correct, to say that against the medical providers and say it was a mistaken payment, something along those lines, something perhaps in a contract area.
Okay.
I want to address the equities because it's important. So what Esurance did is it used the equitable doctrine of rescission to file a DEC action. It's saying, in fairness, we believe we should be able to void the policy. It sued its insured and the injured person. They both answered. I recently looked this up. It's not in the appendixes, but it's a fact in the 16th District Court in Macomb. So they both answer, and then later they don't advise the court of a change in address. They lose touch with them, and a default's taken against them. This order, which is what Esurance relies on to say they've rescinded the policy, is at the outset defective because they never put the MAIPF on notice of that DEC action, and they did not include them. Clearly, the MAIPF is an interested party. The MAIPF should have been included in that, and because they weren't, the order is frankly not worth the paper written on. Second, the fact that they have an order at this point in time is not determinative of whether they still owe payment of the benefits, right? That's what the Supreme Court told us in the Bozzi opinion. They could be right, ultimately. If what they alleged in their DEC action turns out to be true, that's not really the issue here. But hypothetically, say they do have a valid case to rescind, there's still a balancing of the equities test that has to be conducted before they would be relieved of paying the benefits. Obviously, that has never happened. There wasn't the opportunity for that to happen because the MAIPF was not included in the DEC action. I point out later down the road, let me pause and back up actually. It was only around this time, 10, 11 months after the date of the accident, when the DEC action gets filed, it's only around this time that for the first time an application for benefits gets submitted to the plan. Those two things happened within a couple weeks of each other. When I was reading through the briefs, that was not clear to me at all. Reading through the briefs, you would think the timing of things was a claim was made to the MAIPF around the same time it was made to Esurance. That's not the case. It appears that the filing of the DEC action is what caused the claim to be made with MAIPF. So now we have equity squared. Esurance used equity in a unfair way to the MAIPF by not putting them on notice, and now they want to use a vague equitable subrogation theory to assert that they stand now in the shoes of a person that they just sued and represent that person's interest, and that's their only hook for filing this action to seek reimbursement. I would say three things really. First is the law. There's no theory. I've said that. I don't want to beat that horse to death, but that's probably the most important thing. Second, I would point out equity aids the vigilant, not those that slumber. There's no explanation provided for why they would pay as much and as long as they did and to assert a theory that could have been asserted at the outset. And this court should not bend over backwards to assist them with that. Next, this point was brought up below, but when you come to the court and you are asking the court to do equity for you, you have to have clean hands. The way Esurance has gone about doing things is anything but clean hands. When they filed the DEC action against the MAIPF, they inexplicably file it in a completely different courthouse in a completely different jurisdiction. They put on the caption that there was a prior action, but it's the information's incorrect. It's not actually the action it's not the information for the action against the insured and the injured person. It's just incorrect information. So they keep MAIPF out of the situation until they have their order. Then they file against MAIPF this action more than a year after the date of the accident. Well, close to more than a year and a half after the date of the accident. Relying only on an order that the MAIPF should have been a party to before something like that was entered. It is not actions that speak of clean hands. It is actions that speak of an effort to be deceptive. I just want to end by circling back to the beginning. There's no authority for this action. The legislature could have done that. And even though it seems novel, it does not immediately strike you that this could be as significant of a case as it has a potential to be. I fear that if you were to agree with the Esurance, could be a tremendously significant case because it would require the assigned claims to take on a fundamentally different role than what it was designed to do in the no-fault act. And that role would be to act as an insurer to insurance companies that think differently about whether they should have made payments as opposed to being the backstop to provide benefits for injured people who don't have another insurance carrier to go to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
No. All right. Brief rebuttal.
Well, it's not a situation where the assigned claims has to step up for claims that we think were improperly paid. This was a default judgment. It can't be collaterally attacked. And more importantly, it has been collaterally attacked in this case.
Why weren't they named as a party in that other action?
I don't know of any authority that would require them to. And here's the thing. If you file a DEC action of that nature, we name our insured and the potential claimants under the policy. We don't know what we would have to name every other insurer in the state because we don't know what other carrier might get stuck in the next line of priority once our policy is rescinded. So those are the only parties that are necessary, in my view, for a rescission action like this. But the issue here is...
Well, that may be true for the rescission, but if you then want to go after the facility, it does seem a bit odd that they weren't involved in the next act or in the first action, but then immediately once you got your default judgment, you went after them. I mean, it's not a stretch to think that this may have been a litigation strategy rather than, oh, we have a default judgment, who should we go after? And, you know, oh, let's go after the facility.
All right, well, the fact that it's a litigation strategy wouldn't necessarily make it wrong or invalidate the default judgment, but at the end of the day, I just don't know what required us to add them. And again, like I said, we don't know, we rescind that policy, it's taken out of the order of priority. We don't know who steps up then. And then that entity can come in and say, now we're stuck with a liability or an exposure that we wouldn't have been if your policy hadn't been voided. So now we're an interested party. And the next one after that, if they're equal, we don't know. We don't know where that ends. And so we have to look at who's claiming under the policy and who our insureds are as the people that would be making the argument. And the interesting thing, too, is about the balancing of the equities. That would be entirely an argument for the insured and or the injured person to be making. I don't know what assigned claims interest in that would be to say, well, there's an unfairness here because A defrauded B, and I'm somehow, you know, they're not a party to the formation of the contract, they're not a claimant under the contract. I just don't know where that argument comes from. But in this case, specifically said in the motion, for the purposes of the CA's motion, we accept that Esurance policy was, quote, fairly and legally rescinded, end quote. And they also said it was voided ab initio by that action. So it's an entirely new argument for the first time on appeal. I mean, this was a C8 motion. This wasn't if it was a C10 argument, we would have had a rebuttal burden and it would have been a lot better record to talk about this. The bottom line is they simply said you don't have a claim under the statute and or maybe we don't really get to be sued at all. And that was kind of it. And the motion that they filed specifically did not raise a challenge to the default judgment. So I'm not going to say it's waived, because I suppose if it's remanded, they could make an argument about that in some future motion, but it's just not a part of this record. And I don't think it's, I just don't know what would have required us to add them to that, because then you're just opening the door to where can we, how many entities do we have to bring into those actions, and then we have to serve them all, and then all of a sudden everybody gets a say in whether this, whether A properly got a policy from B, and C gets to claim on it, and whether DEF and all these other entities might possibly be responsible if we're taken out. It just becomes a mess. And I would explain, too, the supposed unclean hands in that we waited, you know, from a January 2016 accident to file a rescission action in November. I mean, I think that's kind of pretty quick. I mean, 10 months, I mean, if you were to file a suit and do discovery and find the basis of a rescission, fraud is inherently hard to detect. If we could find it quickly, we wouldn't have issued the policy in the first place. So I don't think we necessarily should be punished for not uncovering and establishing the fraud quickly enough. And again, I mean, the main argument seems to be, keeps coming back to this not being in the statute, but it's not in the statute for two carriers fighting out either. It wasn't in the statute for Titan versus North Shore in 2006 or any of the other published cases like Federal Kemper that have recognized this. Questions?
No. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you both for your fine arguments. The matter is submitted.